Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of Conversations at the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. Nearly 15 years after September 11, there's still no end in sight for the war on terror. This week's episode focuses on the battle against Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and other terror organizations around the globe. In this hour, we'll hear from Mark Danner. He's the author of Spiral, Trapped in a Forever War. He's also a journalism professor at UC Berkeley. This conversation was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now to our moderator, Nancy Jarvis. She's an attorney and a World Affairs trustee.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us. I am Nancy Jarvis, and tonight we're in conversation with Mark Danner, an extraordinary journalist who has written about human rights abuses for over 30 years. Mark is currently Chancellor's Professor of English and Journalism at UC Berkeley, and the James Clark Chase Professor of Foreign Affairs and Humanities at Bard College, New York. He began his career at The New Yorker and the New York Review of Books. A former MacArthur Fellow, he also has a longtime association with the Telluride Film Festival. Mark is not an armchair analyst. He has covered Central America, Haiti, the Balkans, Iraq, and the greater Middle East on the ground. His new book, Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War, has its origins in an invitation by John Hennessy, the president of Stanford University, to deliver the Tanner Lectures on Human Values. The book explores the battle against terrorism that began in 2001 and its effect on America. It is intended to provoke discussion of what kind of country Americans want. Please join me in welcoming Mark Danner. Mark, before engaging the thesis of your book, I thought it would be enlightening to learn a little bit more about your career, particularly for our listeners who may be searching for ways to contribute meaningfully in today's world. You're a spectacular product of a liberal arts education. At Harvard, you studied philosophy, literature, religion, art history, and international relations, and graduated with an interdisciplinary honors concentration. I would appreciate your telling us how that led you to Manhattan and New York, The New Yorker and the New York Review of Books, and then on for 30 years to independent investigation of human rights abuses in all of the corners of the globe.
Well, thank you very much, Nancy, for asking that. And thank you all for being here this evening. That's a very large question. You're here. How did you get here? My last book, the one before this one, I dedicated it to my mother in partial answer, as I said, to her constant question, why don't you go somewhere nice for a change? I suppose that the question of how I got here is, first of all, should be answered by the word serendipity. I certainly didn't intend to write about the things I write about. I didn't have any plan to do that. I very much appreciate what you said about humanities education. I'm very much in favor of humanities education. And it is true, if I'm a spectacular product of such an education, as you very generously said, it's essentially because I couldn't make up my mind. I was a philosophy major. Harvard had a very mathematically inclined philosophy department at the time, which didn't particularly please me. I migrated to religion, after that to English, then to literature. And as you say, my final concentration was really a combination of philosophy and literature. I had a very broad interest in the humanities in general, and by this I mean an attempt through clear-eyed looking, seeing, reading, to try to understand the world, to try to understand what is happening around us. And I think that that education has been enormously helpful to me in trying to get or at least I hope it's been helpful to me in trying to get beyond the narratives that we use to understand the world. And by those narratives, I mean the war on terror is one, for example. How do you get beyond this notion that we are fighting terrorism and fighting terrorism and fighting terrorism and get beyond this kind of arc of understanding and get to, I'd call a more baseline conception of what exactly we're doing. And in this book, I try to describe in spiral, and the image of spiral is the idea of you start at a fixed point and you keep circling, circling, and you get farther and farther away from the point where you began. And I try to ask the question, why have we done this in the war on terror? Why in the first year of the war on terror were there 700 terrorist attacks around the world, and this past year there were 33,000? Both of those figures come from the Department of State. And I think that one of the things that philosophy taught me, and literary criticism as well, is really how to read documents, how to try to get to the bottom of bureaucratic stratagems, how to try to understand the workings of particular organizations. I think it's impossible to understand the war on terror, for example, without a conception of the bureaucracies, the national security bureaucracies that grew up in the United States in the wake of the Second World War, that grew up in the wake of the National Security Act of 1947, when the Defense Department was created, when the Central Intelligence Agency was created, when the National Security Agency was created. All of these institutions were there on 9/11, and in a sense, having had a 10-year hiatus since the end of the Cold War, kind of slowly rumbled back into action. A new Cold War, in a sense, when it comes to America's national security bureaucracies, had begun. And I think looking at that history is absolutely essential to understanding how the United States has fought the war on terror and why the country seems to have made, with so many smart people in control of these bureaucracies, what I consider to be momentous mistakes. And I don't think those mistakes are by happenstance. I think they are deeply embedded in our history. And you can detect them, you can study them and try to understand them if you look at the documents, if you carefully, if you know how to read. And when I say read, I'm talking about reading and interpreting, trying to see beyond the documents into how they fit into a larger history. And I like to think that a humanities education at its best teaches you how to do that. You know, I gave a commencement address at Berkeley, 15 years ago, which was entitled, "What Are You Going to Do With That?" And it was the quotation from parents who say to their, you know, child when he or she comes home from the first year of college and says, "I'm going to be an English major," or "I'm going to be a philosophy major. What are you going to do with that?" And I was trying to answer that question, that in fact, there are a lot of things that you can do with that, principally trying to see through the kind of mephitic cloud of propaganda, fragmentary stories, bits and pieces of slogans and sloganeering that constitute our political discussion today, trying to see through it and actually see why things happen the way they do, which I think is one of the things I've been trying to do for the last few decades, to try to understand why massacres and other human rights abuses happen, to try to understand why the United States behaves the way it does in the world, and specifically for this book, to try to understand how the U.S. has become involved in a war on terror that's boundless in space, boundless in time, seems to have no sense of an ending, and has involved breaking many of our most basic precepts about what supposedly constitutes and separates the United States from other countries. It's led the U.S. to torture prisoners, which is against federal law and against international law. It's led the U.S. to imprison people indefinitely. There's still 76 prisoners imprisoned at Guantanamo, who are there, so far as we know, for the rest of their natural lives. It's led the United States to assassinate 4,000 to 5,000 people using drones. It's led to warrantless wiretapping. All of these things are going on rather quietly. There aren't many protests about them. And it also has led us to have a presidential candidate this year who advocates very forthrightly, very angrily, torturing prisoners, not only waterboarding, but doing, as he says, much worse. Even if it doesn't work, they deserve it because of what they do to us, he has said. He advocates killing the families of terrorists. He advocates a number of things that I would argue 15 years ago would have been absolutely unheard of in our public life. And yet now we may say, goodness, this is shocking, but in general, it fits into a changed, dramatically altered polity that I think we very rarely take account of. It's grown up all around us. A quiet war is continuing right now. It's going on the other side of the world. We're attacking with drones in Yemen and Pakistan and Afghanistan and Somalia and Libya, possibly other places. We have troops on the ground in Syria and in Iraq. One can go on with this. But I think one of the difficulties we have is actually seeing what's in front of us. I think that becomes very difficult. You know, there's an old phrase in journalism, you know, the interesting story is the interesting story is man bites dog, right? Dog bites man is not a story. Man bites dog, that's a story. And the problem is that increasingly, as you have a war that continues quietly, unendingly, it's no longer a story. It's simply part of the world as it exists. It's hard for us to see it. It's hard for us to see how things have changed, how our approach to politics has altered, and how our daily existence has been changed by a forever war, as I call it in this book. So, you know, I'm glad you started with this as a point of departure, because I'm very grateful for my education, because I think in the best sense of the word, it taught me to look at things and to try to see a little bit deeper. And when young people, as they increasingly do, ask me what they should do, you know, in preparation for a career in journalism or writing, I tend to urge them, you know, I'm very much a big fan of a humanistic education, a very big fan, because I think we all need to do better at the basic work of seeing.
To take up the thread from your book, in Spiral, you decry the politics of fear. You describe it as embedding the rhetoric of the war on terror into the political struggle between the two parties. Since you wrote that book, I think that tendency has increased, if anything. I think we all acknowledge that it exists. How do we counteract it?
Well, that's a very good question. I don't know really how to begin to talk about how to counteract it, because, you know, we have a basic phenomenon. It's called terrorism. There are historical reasons it's called that, but it's very useful just to look at that word. Terrorism is about taking action that causes terror in a population. Reality is not killing. Killing is, in a sense, a kind of byproduct. What you really want to do is cause fear. And you cause fear to have a secondary result, to have people do things. And one of my contentions in this book is that, you know, this difference between 700-odd attacks in the year after 9/11 and 33,000 now, the difference in the fact that at the time of the 9/11 attacks, al-Qaeda was 1,000 or so militants in the mountains of Afghanistan, whereas now you have jihadist groups, including al-Qaeda, in dozens, literally dozens of countries around the world. You have not one international network of terrorists, very able international network of terrorists, Al-Qaeda. Not one, but two. The Islamic State, which came of the Iraq War, has joined Al-Qaeda. It's much bigger. It's occupying territory the size of Great Britain over the border of Iraq and Syria. It has 30 to 40,000 fighters. How did this happen? In other words, how did a small group of 1,000 or so fighters isolated in the mountains of Afghanistan lead to this enormous phenomenon that has dominated the foreign policy of the United States ever since 9/11? How did it happen that while there may have been 1,000 militants in 2001, there are now probably 40 or 50,000? They're sympathizers in all the Western countries, thousands of them, including in the United States. How did that happen? And I think, you know, how does it happen that you design and carry out an act, the purpose of which is to cause fear? How does it happen that within 15 years, you've increased your numbers 50-fold, at least? How does it happen that you're now in every country of the Middle East and are a predominant force in a number of countries in the Middle East, Yemen, Libya, Syria, Iraq? How has that happened in that short amount of time? And I would say, you know, there's a basic precept here. If you don't have an army, use your adversary's army. And Al-Qaeda attacked on September 11th in order to provoke, this I call the strategy of provocation, the United States to do stupid things that would increase their recruitment. They wanted, the Al-Qaeda wanted the United States, and we know this from the documents, I have one right here that sets it out very explicitly, they wanted to provoke the United States to invade a major Muslim country, to put on the television screen every day images of Americans repressing, suppressing, abusing Muslims. They thought that the United States would invade Afghanistan, and there would be a struggle to the death, a quagmire there, as there had been with the Soviet Union a decade before. The United States military would be destroyed in Afghanistan. The U.S. would disappear as a superpower, as the Soviet Union did. That was the theory. But the United States obliged Al-Qaeda by doing something much more useful to them. We invaded Iraq. We gave them those images. In fact, it was a dream, a fantasy of bin Laden's to have images like those from Abu Ghraib, which still fertilized the ranks of jihadists around the world. When you see a young Westerner kneeling in this vacant landscape in an orange jumpsuit with a man in black standing behind him with a knife at his throat, declaiming, and then cutting his head off, this image that we all know now, sadly. When you see that, how many here realize that that's a reference to Guantanamo, that orange jumpsuit? I assure you everybody in the Middle East does. This imagery for the Islamic State and for Al-Qaeda is a kind of synthetic imagery that goes back and forth, and that is about the United States in many cases, although Americans tend not to realize it. So the strategy of provocation led us to invade Iraq. It vastly increased the recruitment of Al-Qaeda and other jihadist groups. It started in 2003, the Islamic State, which made a series of dramatic attacks in August of that year. Blew up the United Nations headquarters, blew up the Jordanian embassy, blew up the Grand Mosque in Najaf. You know, the Islamic State was absolutely a stepchild, direct stepchild of the Iraq War. So, in effect, you know, you ask originally this question way back when, how do we stop this? How do we stop being frightened? You know, I think it's very difficult to come up with an answer because the second half of this dynamic, the first half is causing fear. The second half is you will always have politicians, leaders, who find it incumbent on them to ride the wave of fear. And this happened after 9/11. It's happening in our election at the moment. Terrorism creates an opportunity in which politicians in the terrorized country, the phrase is surf fear for votes. That's Senator Claire McCaskill's phrase. And you see it right now with Mr. Trump. You see a very, you know, absolutely opportunistic politics in which he is trying to get elected on fear. How can you counteract it? Well, there could have been a different reaction to September 11th. The president could have gotten up and said, this is the most horrible attack on the United States in our history. It's absolutely shocking. It's suicide bombing, killed nearly 3,000 civilians. We will bring these people to justice, but we're not going to overreact. There's no reason to invade any countries. We have a target of this militant group. We are going to track them down and kill them. But there is no reason to occupy anywhere. There's no reason to send our army. We're going to fight this war with special forces, intelligence, assets. We're going to track down every one of these people. But we're going to do it while not doing what they want us to do, which is they want us to alienate the Muslim world. They want us to alienate young Muslims so they will join their group. And we're going to do everything we can to avoid doing that. Our actions are going to be surgical. They're going to be direct. They are going to attack the problem. We are probably not going to eliminate all terrorism, but we are going to protect the country and we're going to destroy the group that attacked us while making sure that we don't create more terrorists at the same time. And I think that kind of clear leadership might have made a difference. I think, though, that the United States leadership at the time of 9/11 had bigger fish to fry. That is, many of the people in leadership positions, particularly in the Defense Department, believed that the United States was in a so-called unipolar moment, unipolar meaning one pole, that the bipolar world had ended, there was only the United States as a great power, and 9/11 to them represented an opportunity to be the predominant power in the world, to show off our military force, to use shock and awe, and to send the American army into a major Arab capital where the United States could restore its credibility by occupying, as it happened, Iraq. And I think that was precisely the wrong strategy. And I think the fact is that that strategy led the U.S. political leadership to use the 9/11 attacks as a spur to military action and to, in effect, increase the fear in the country. In other words, to exaggerate the threat of al-Qaeda, to say that this is an existential threat to us. And al-Qaeda wasn't an existential threat to us. In the first speech that President Bush gave in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, the big speech to Congress, he compared al-Qaeda specifically to Hitler and to Stalin, to the Soviet Union and to Nazi Germany. Very explicit quote. And this quote was misbegotten. You know, this did not, al-Qaeda had no enormous army. It was not going to destroy the country. In effect, it was trying to provoke us to do things that would help the organization. And all along, we have continually done those things, which is one of the points of Spiral.
We have a few minutes more for our conversation. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that during the question period, there will be many questions on the current war on terror. But in the last few minutes before we take questions, I'd like you to step back a moment and think about your coverage of violence in El Salvador and Haiti, the Balkans, and the Middle East. Is there any thread among those investigations? Or is each case unique? You spent your life doing this. Are there lessons to be learned in the entire trajectory, or not?
Oh boy, why do you ask such difficult questions?
Because I'm an old friend.
I would say there are many things in common, and you know, for me personally, one of the things all of those places have in common is the kind of voluptuous thrill of reporting, of getting to know a new place, of trying to understand the strangeness of it, of thinking when you're far away from it that you understand it, and arriving and finding out that you know nothing, that suddenly you're dependent not on accounts of newspaper writers and writers who covered it, but you're suddenly dependent on your own sense impressions, on what you hear, what you see, what you feel, what you taste. So part of it, I think, is just the thrill of trying to understand somewhere, and particularly a place that, you know, I called my last book Stripping Bare the Body, which is after a quote by a sometime Haitian president. He was overthrown in a coup after 5 months, as just about all Haitian presidents are these days. And he said, political violence is like stripping bare the body. The better to place the stethoscope and hear what goes on beneath the skin. And I think that's very much true, that you see and understand a society best when you see it essentially tearing itself apart, and the various parts going after each other. And I think, indeed, that's true of post-9/11 America as well. So I think that's one thing I would say is a common thread, is just my own pleasure, really, an intellectual interest in trying to understand places. A second thread, I think, is the influence of the United States and how prone the U.S. is to use its power in ways that turn out to be misbegotten, misinformed, counterproductive, where consequences are surprising and go in a different direction than U.S. policymakers, however high-minded they might have been, which sometimes happens, that are completely different from what they planned. And I think there's an interesting trajectory there. You know, when you look at the invasion of Iraq, which I talked about a moment ago, many, many, many of my friends who had similar political sympathies, and I'm talking about reporters a lot of times, and intellectuals, writers, to my shock, supported the invasion of Iraq. And of course, this is a phenomenon that's well known, liberal interventionists. A great many people, good friends of mine, were for it. And I was so shocked by this, I ended up debating publicly against the war continually with Christopher Hitchens and Leon Wieseltier and various other people. And I think the reason for that has to do with the thread that you're talking about, which is that in the wake of the Cold War, and particularly during the Balkan Wars, which were singularly bloody wars, you know, genocidal wars, people started to ask themselves, as Madeleine Albright put it to Colin Powell, why do we have this fancy military of yours if we're not going to use it? You know, if you're on the ground in Bosnia or in Sarajevo, for example, looking at the aftermath of a mortar bomb that kills 68 people, as I was, and you look up in the air and see an American jet, fighter bomber, circling around and around and doing nothing, you ask yourself, why doesn't the U.S. do something? You know, these people are being massacred. They're being killed. They're civilians. The United States is all powerful. I mean, this is the unipolar moment. Why doesn't the U.S. act? And I think that that question, which was asked repeatedly in the 90s about Bosnia and about Rwanda as well, where there was an enormous genocide, really persisted into 2001 and 2003, into the beginnings of the Iraq War. I think many of the people who you might have been expected to be against a war of choice in the Middle East looked at Iraq and said, well, why shouldn't the U.S. act to bring down this dictator, which is, of course, the way the war was sold by Washington. And I think there is a kind of thread running through all the interventions you talked about, which has to do with the wisdom of U.S. action, whether the United States can act in the world in a way that brings positive results. And I, at the beginning of the discussion about Iraq, I was vehemently, from the beginning, against the invasion. And I wish I could say because I knew it would be a disaster, but there was something very instinctual to me that said there'd be a disaster that I think lies in the fact, in the reporting I did, in particular, oddly enough, in Haiti, which is about as different a country from Iraq as you can possibly understand. Haiti, for me, was a kind of education in foreign policy and in foreign reporting. It's an amazing, fascinating place. And I really got an education there in how U.S. action, you know, the United States is 300 million people, Haiti is 8 million. The U.S. tried again and again to alter Haitian politics. And even though it's an exponentially greater power, again and again, its efforts came to grief in Haiti. And I think this left me with a feeling that, you know, U.S. power, in fact, is not very useful in creating a new order. It's very good at blowing things up. We're very good at destroying things, at destroying regimes, at bombing, but actually creating a new order to put in place of what we've destroyed is something that we really don't know how to do. And I think that's been demonstrated again and again, and I've seen it in my own writing life. So I think that's one of the threads, I think, that runs through what I've written about, absolutely.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of Conversations at the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Mark Danner. He's the author of Spiral, Trapped in a Forever War. He's in conversation with Nancy Jarvis, who is an attorney and a World Affairs trustee. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. Ours is a membership organization. You can join by visiting us at worldaffairs.org. And now back to our conversation.
Okay, now we will have a chance to take your questions. This is from a member of the audience who is U.S. Army retired. When there was a draft national service, theoretically there was more of a connection between the policymakers, populace, and the armed forces. Should we return to or go to a mandatory national service obligation for citizens?
You know, I honestly don't know what I think about that. I mean, it's interesting that after Vietnam, the military was really redesigned during the 70s after the draft to prevent, I mean, you think that the question kind of presumes as a premise that having a draft will act as a kind of restraint on American action because it will embed decisions about U.S. intervention in much more within the populace. It will give many more people of different classes a stake once the United States intervenes abroad. The interesting thing is that in the 70s, the U.S. military was designed in such a way that the U.S. could not fight a long engagement without calling up the reserves, calling up the National Guard, which is why in Iraq you had this amazing patchwork of professional soldiers and reservists. This was supposed to restrain any long-time intervention because, you know, supposedly the populace would react against it. It wouldn't be possible to fight it with reservists. In effect, though, what happened was you did use the reserves. People had to go to deployment after deployment. Some people had three and four deployments. It was very unfair to a lot of families. So it didn't work. You know, the theory of the 70s that this would act as a kind of restraint on U.S. adventurism around the world, in effect, did not work. But, you know, I'm sympathetic to the idea of a draft because I think it spreads the burden equitably as it is not now spread. On the other hand, the U.S. military is a relatively smaller professional force now, where everybody fighting, at least until recently, were volunteers. Now they've had stop gaps and they're forcing people, as I implied, to fight more than they signed up for. So I guess I'm not, at the end of the day, I'm not sympathetic to that proposal. But
this is a question from a Bard College alum.
Ah.
In response to recent events all over France, do you think the state of emergency is more helpful or harmful? And do you think the rhetoric Hollande is using will have long-lasting negative effects on the population?
That's a very difficult question. You know, in effect, we have a state of emergency in this country that's lasted 15 years. I mean, in effect, not only in effect, we have a legal state of emergency, and we have what I call in the book a state of exception, which I tried to describe a little while back, that's lasted for a very long time. The French have a formal state of emergency. You know, the truth is that when it comes to terrorism, one of the things that happens is that politicians feel that they have to do something. In other words, each terrorist attack requires, the phrase was after 9/11, taking the gloves off. And the implication of taking the gloves off is to say that before the attack, the gloves were on. In other words, the implication is that the reason the attack succeeded was because the government wasn't being tough enough, strong-willed enough, powerful enough, repressive enough, if you will, to prevent the attack. And the fact is that this logic is not true. The 9/11 attacks, if the United States government, the national security bureaucracy, did not need any new laws, would not have needed any new laws to have prevented the 9/11 attacks. And in effect, there were many, many close calls which would have and could have led to those attacks being scuttled in the months before September 11th. You had someone in Phoenix who, in the FBI, who said, you know, there are many people who are training in flight simulators from the Middle East who don't want to learn how to land necessarily and take off. Shouldn't we investigate this? Nothing was done. You had Moussaoui, who was arrested in Minnesota for exactly the same reason, who the FBI was desperate to get a court order to look at his laptop. The court order was not, or I'm sorry, it wasn't a court order, it was from the Justice Department. It was not granted. Had that laptop been looked at, it's quite possible that the 9/11 attacks would have been stopped. And I could cite other things in the months before September 11th. So including, by the way, two of the 9/11 terrorists were under CIA observation until they arrived in San Diego, when the CIA did not hand them off, as they are supposed to do, to the FBI. And we've heard again and again that the reason this happened was because they failed to connect the dots. It was some bureaucratic oversight. It wasn't. There was clearly something intentional about this. A lot of people think, and I tend to agree with this, that the CIA hoped the Saudis would turn these people and make them into informants. It didn't work out quite that way. They flew a plane into the Pentagon. Anyway, my general point here is that when you have an attack, there is immediate, enormous pressure on politicians to do something. And many times, you know, cranking up the repression, cranking up the state of emergency and so on is not required to necessarily stop terrorist attacks. I mean, if you have 10 terrorist attempts, one will probably succeed. One will probably succeed in this country, I think, leading up to the election. I'm going to make that prediction right now. The fact is, you're not going to stop all of them. And because one succeeds does not necessarily mean that the gloves were on and the gloves need to be taken off. But you have this kind of cycle that begins where each successful attack causes more repressive steps to be taken, whether or not they are necessary. And I think that is that's happening in France. I think it will happen in Germany. I think it is likely to happen in this country if you have an attack in late October leading up to the election, which I think is rather predictable. I mean, who knows, maybe it won't happen. But if I were the people in the Islamic State in Raqqa, in their headquarters, I would be planning an attack before the election because I would want to elect the Republican candidate. I think that would be enormously useful for them. And I think really that's kind of the way he'll be elected, if indeed you have an attack very close to the election. But if that happens, you probably will have more of a state of emergency, you'll have steps taken and so on, and it does not follow necessarily that those things are needed. I realize that sounds a little paradoxical, but one of the problems with terrorism is that there will be some successful attacks. If you have enough attempts, there will be some successful attacks. It just will happen.
There's a question from a member of the World Affairs Council Summer Institute. I would argue that America has spiraled away from a clear foreign policy doctrine. How do we return to a clear doctrine and ensure America stays on point?
Well, the U.S. has many doctrines. The one in the Middle East is the Carter Doctrine, which obviously goes back to 1980, I believe, 79 or 80. And I would agree that that one is outdated. It's about protecting the Middle East oil from any foreign usurpers. That is what governs U.S. policy, you know, grand policy in the Middle East to this day. I think that's probably out of date. But I think in a broader sense, we have had really since the handoff of imperial power in the late 40s from Great Britain to the United States, we have carried a kind of imperial burden in the Middle East. It's been quite similar to that of Great Britain and France, the former colonial powers there. And I think that order is breaking down. I think you see it breaking down all around you. If you look at the map, there are hot wars going on in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, in Libya. Many of these concern borders that were put into place in the Sykes-Picot Agreement in 1916, so exactly a century ago. The Islamic State put out a great video. I really recommend their videos. They're very entertaining and highly, very well produced, called Breaking the Borders, when they bulldozed the border between Iraq and Syria. And their big belief is that these imperial borders must be destroyed, that were these borders that were imposed a century ago by the Western powers. But I think this old imperial order that we inherited from the British and the French is indeed collapsing. And I think it's unclear what will take its place. I do know that the United States won't determine what will take its place. The people of the region will. And one of the interesting things about Obama's foreign policy is he has tried to step back slightly from the Middle East. He has almost heroically avoided getting involved in Syria, which I think almost any other president in his position would be deeply involved in Syria. Most of his senior advisors were pushing for greater involvement in Syria. But I think he is right. He has been right to stay out of it. And I think we're going to see a lot more turmoil in the Middle East. And I think the United States does not have the wisdom to produce a successor order in the Middle East. You know, it's interesting, around the time of the Iraq invasion by the United States, there was a lot of talk in conservative, neoconservative circles, as they were called then, of creative destabilization, creative chaos, that we're going to go in and bust them up. You know, we're going to bust up this old order by invading Iraq, and we'll start a democratic tsunami. That was the phrase of one neoconservative, that the idea, I wrote about this before the war, that, you know, we'll invade Iraq, we'll make it a democracy or a representative government, and that will lead to a democratic revolution in Iran. That will lead to the fall of Assad in Syria. That will lead to the fall of Arafat, who is then running the Palestinian Authority. You would have all these democracies. It'll establish all, you know, it'll be like what happened in Eastern Europe. And indeed, there was a destabilization, but it wasn't necessarily a creative one. We don't know what will be created there. But I think, indeed, one of the consequences of the invasion has been this massive destabilization of the Middle East, of the old order. It shows the fragility of the old order. And it's this old order, it's worth saying, and this we come back to the beginning of the discussion, which is what the jihadists on 9/11 were seeking to destabilize. They were not only trying to provoke the United States, they were also striking at what they called the far enemy. The far enemy being the U.S., which in their view was the puppet master holding the strings of the puppets of the Middle East, Mubarak, the House of Saud in Saudi Arabia, other rulers, other autocrats who relied on our support. How do we overthrow these autocrats? Well, we can't overthrow them directly because they're too strong and ruthless. We'll overthrow them by attacking the far enemy and driving it out of the Middle East. And then if we cut the strings of those, of the puppeteer, the puppets will fall limply to earth and we will be able to take over Egypt, we'll be able to take over Saudi Arabia, and so on. So our presence as a neo-imperial power in the region was what provoked, you know, when you ask, why do they hate us? You know, this question in the American press, that's why they hate us, you know, because we're supporting autocrats who are repressing them. It's not that complicated. We hear again and again in the U.S. press, you know, why are they radicalized? Why, as if it's this mysterious drug that they're taking that radicalizes people. But it's not, I don't think it's, I mean, radicalization is an interesting phenomenon and complicated, but at its root, it's not very complicated. The U.S. is the imperial power. It's supporting autocratic regimes. Autocratic regimes are repressive. They want to overthrow them. And to, notwithstanding, to put in their place even more autocratic regimes, that's quite true. So I'm sorry, I've gone far afield from the question of what should be the U.S., new U.S. doctrine. But, you know, Obama has wanted to pivot to Asia, and he's been frustrated throughout by this complete attention to the Middle East. And he has argued, and I agree with him, that it's somewhat misplaced, that this dominant attention that we're paying to the Middle East and South Asia is not in U.S. interest. And I tend to agree.
There are several questions here on Hillary Clinton, so I'll give them to you together.
Oh, good.
How should Hillary Clinton approach terrorism leading up to the election? And how do you assess Hillary Clinton as a hawk, the mistake of her vote for the Iraq war and her policy going forward?
Well, if I were in the place of the Democratic nominee, as she will be, then I would be very worried, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, that in the run-up to the election, there will be an attack on American soil. I would find that to be a frightening prospect. And if you read the speech of the Republican nominee, in accepting the nomination, it is almost laying the groundwork for more chaos, more shooting of police officers, more terrorism. It's a kind of predicate for that. I'm not accusing him of that, but I'm just saying that indeed it's this dark vision that needs to be confirmed by further acts. And it's a fascinating document if you read it closely. I urge people to watch that speech. But what can she do in the run-up? I mean, she's not in the government at the moment. I think she can make very clear what she believes policy should be about terrorism. She should make it clear that the current administration is fighting and defeating the Islamic State on the ground, that in fact some of the larger acts of terrorism in Europe are probably a result of the fact that they are suffering these defeats in Syria and Iraq. In a sense, terrorism is their strategic weapon. It's their air force. So the more you defeat them in Fallujah or maybe in Mosul, the more attacks they're going to be abroad, and that's been precisely what's been happening. I think she should try to make clear that we can do something about this and that the United States is doing something about it, but it's impossible to prevent all terrorism. I think she needs to speak rationally and clearly. But to say this, as I'm listening to myself say it, is to underline the futility of her position in relation to her opponent in the wake of an attack, because the power of his politics is, you know, directed at the limbic system, you know, the lizard brain. It's about fear. And that is the power of his politics. And that is why, if you have a real attack, it will help him. The other thing she will do, and I think she should do, but she will do, is try to attack him as unsteady, as erratic, as unreliable, and to try to make enough people more afraid of him than they are of terrorists. And that is going on right now at the convention. It will continue to go on over the next weeks and months. You know, I take some solace from the fact that in the wake of the Orlando attack, he made a real attempt to seize on this and put his poll numbers up in his reaction to the attack, and it didn't really work. It didn't really work. It may be because the attack was different. You know, it was hate crime. It was kind of mixed in a way that, yeah, I mean, imagine somebody wandering into McDonald's in Times Square and blowing themselves up and killing 30 people. Imagine the kind of impact that would have. But I think if I had to counsel her, I would say to speak loudly and clearly about terrorism, about the fact that she knows what she's doing when it comes to terrorism. She will follow these policies. But if you look at, again, the reaction to Orlando, you can see how different. Trump essentially said, we need to go and kill these people. And Clinton did what I'm saying. And in fact, in the wake of that kind of fear, he has a leg up in that kind of reaction. And this is always true politically. So what do I think of her as a hawk was the other question. I think that anyone who saw themselves as the Salvadorans called, say it, presidenciable, you know, that's a French pronunciation, that is possibly eligible for the presidency in 2002, the pro-Iraq war vote was the smart vote. No one who was thinking of running for office voted against the war. And I think she thought at the time that it was the smart vote. I don't mean that, you know, deep down she thought it was a terrible idea, but she felt she had to vote that way for political reasons. I think there is a streak in her, as the questioner really points out, that believes in a strong U.S. Foreign policy that uses as its backbone military force. And I think if she was president in 2011, 2012, we probably would have had an involvement on the part of the United States in Syria, which I think would have been a profound mistake. I disagree with those who think the U.S. could have played a predominant role and could have stopped that war early. I don't think it would have happened. So I'm a bit apprehensive about Clinton as president, if she becomes president, although not half as apprehensive I would be as if she didn't become president, because she does indeed have a very strong, I think, aggressive streak when it comes to U.S. military power. And I think if the last 15 years has shown anything to us, it's that prolonged and persistent use of violence is often counterproductive. It often is. And it should also be said that it can be very hard, particularly in the wake of an attack, to resist the use of violence. Very hard. That the person in the room who advocates harsh, immediate harsh action, I'm talking about in the councils of state, very often has a great advantage. You know, the certainty that indeed we have to respond fiercely and immediately. The person who counsels patience and a more measured response is often in a very weak position. I have a lot of respect for Obama that he didn't intervene in Syria, because I think all of his major advisors wanted him to.
There's a question from a member of the audience who is preparing to join the U.S. mission to Somalia. Given our not-so-great track record of post-conflict nation-building, what are our best capabilities to contribute to states emerging from conflict and instability? how might we promote and create space for building understanding before overreacting?
Boy, that's a very good question and a really complicated one. We'd like to say that the key thing really is building institutions on the ground. If you look, for example, at Indonesia, which has really had a working democracy for the last 14, 15 years after a long period of dictatorship, you can look at what the U.S. did there during those years of dictatorship. And one of the things it did was help NGOs, help establish civil institutions, help establish a civil society, the Ford Foundation, other organizations. This is a complicated story, needless to say, and contradictory in some ways. But one would like to say that establishing such institutions, such countervailing institutions, civil institutions, is something that the United States actually knows how to do, and that can have long-term positive effects. The problem is long-term positive effects that, people like to see quick action. Libya, look at Libya. It's a very good example. The United States played a major role in overthrowing the Gaddafi regime. There were reasons that people in the government advocated this, one of them being that they thought there was going to be widespread killing during this revolution. But in the wake of the overthrow of the regime, the country is divided between a couple of different governments. There's widespread violence. It threatens to break apart. Could the United States have done anything to prevent this? And I'm hard-pressed to answer that. Would the U.S. have had to put... if there was a United Nations constabulary force that perhaps could have... but now we're into the notion of blue helmets, of peacekeepers, which have had a very mixed record around the world. I think that very often in a situation like Libya, in which there are very few national institutions, in which the country is essentially stitched together, it's kind of an artificial country in many ways, made of three different parts, I don't think the U.S. could have, I hate to say it, could have done much. On the other hand, I think that the work of trying to establish institutions on the ground, trying to build civic institutions within a society, particularly like Somalia, is God's work. I think it's positive, and it's much more likely at the end of the day to yield positive results than bombing the place. I'm sorry. I wish I could be more, more encouraging.
I would like to say goodnight to our radio listeners. Mark Danner's book, Spiral, is eloquent and unsparing. Thank you, Mark, for your tough-minded reporting.
Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of Conversations at the World Affairs Council. We just heard from Mark Danner. He's the author of Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War. And he was in conversation with Nancy Jarvis, who is an attorney and a World Affairs trustee. Ours is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can join us by visiting worldaffairs.org. This weekly broadcast is made possible by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producers Circle. Our recording engineer is Jim Bennett. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.